The United States and our partners are acting together in a noble purpose. We're out to keep the peace, to make the world more peaceful.
The international community simply is not going to believe any findings put out by an American-only investigation team.
Starting in high school, you have the yearly recruiter that comes. I think our civilian awareness of the military is usually quite high.
There can be no meaningful democracy in Iraq with a government and a system set up under a U.S. military occupation.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, May 8th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The United States will introduce a resolution tomorrow calling for the United Nations to lift sanctions on Iraq immediately and phase out the oil for food aid program over the next 4 months. Diplomats quoted by the Associated Press say the proposal already faces opposition from Russia and France, raising concerns about another divisive diplomatic fray like the one that preceded the U.S.-led invasion to oust Saddam Hussein. The U.S. resolution would also create an international advisory board to audit the spending of income from Iraq's oil industry and to ensure it is benefiting the Iraqi people. That's according to council diplomats who spoke on condition of anonymity. The advisory board would include U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. Washington is setting its sights on Iran and what it believes to be an Iranian nuclear weapons development program. The British public The Guardian reports today that Washington is pressing for a declaration from the International Atomic Energy Agency that Iran had violated the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. If passed, such a declaration would pressure Tehran to account for its activities by referring the matter to the UN Security Council. Relations between Tehran and Washington are already strained. Bush labeled Iran part of so-called Axis of Evil last year, and more recently, Tehran said it would not recognize a U.S.-installed government in Baghdad. The failure of coalition forces to find biological and chemical weapons or weapons of mass destruction in Iraq has been an embarrassment for the Bush administration. Without such findings, the administration stands to lose even more credibility within the international community. But as of yesterday, coalition forces have evidence that White House and Pentagon officials hope will be add some legitimacy to the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of Iraq. Peace Watch spoke with Scott Ritter, former head of the U.N. Weapons Inspector Program in Iraq, about his thoughts on this newfound evidence.
The Pentagon has acknowledged that it has taken into custody a trailer-mounted laboratory, which was actually seized in northern Iraq on April 19th by Kurdish forces, and then this lab was turned over to the United States. It's painted in military olive drab colors, and it is stated to consist of a fermentation unit bolted to the floor and a number of other process-type equipment, which is co-located with this fermentation unit. And while initial assessments and testing have not detected any trace of biological agent or indeed chemical agent, the Pentagon notes that the trailer has been cleaned by a caustic solution which would have neutralized any biological agent. And they feel, based upon the expert analysis of American and British experts who have looked at this trailer, that the only known logical reason for this trailer's existence would be the manufacture of biological agents. That's what the Pentagon has said. The fact of the matter is there's probably a very simple explanation. It has nothing to do with biological weapons whatsoever. In fact, if you ask a biological weapons process specialist, they would state that that which has been described by the Pentagon is incapable of producing biological agent because it's a single fermentation unit. To produce biological agent, you need a stepped-up manufacturing process where you start with a small fermentation unit, you have a transfer process to a larger unit, and even a larger unit, all of which has to be co-located, and this is not that. So you don't produce biological weapons in that which the Pentagon has described. What you do produce, and what this unit probably is a mobile facility for the regeneration of oxidizer used in surface-to-air missiles. Normally, if there were no sanctions, Iraq would cashier the expired oxidizer and buy new oxidizer, but they can't do that because of sanctions, or they couldn't have done that. So they came up with an ingenious method of regenerating oxidizer. This is, you know, a careful chemical process which requires the kind of facilities described by the Pentagon. It's a process that the Iraqis had declared to United Nations weapons inspectors. Indeed, in 1992, I led the investigation into the Iraqi oxidizer regeneration program and am intimately familiar with the process. And I would bet you a dime to a dollar what the Pentagon has gotten their hands on is a mobile surface-to-air missile oxidizer regeneration plant, probably belonging to the Iraqi air defenses, which was captured by the Kurdish forces. It has nothing whatsoever to do with a biological weapons program. You know, let's assume for a second that the Pentagon has it right, that they have found a weapons of mass destruction-related piece of equipment. The Pentagon needs to understand that it has a huge problem. Under what mandate has it received this? What is the chain of custody from a legal process? Who has authorized them to search for this material, and who's going to verify the finding as being legitimate in accordance with international law? You know, the weapons inspectors of the United Nations were mandated to do this task. Weapons inspections is the responsibility of United Nations weapons inspectors. There is no mandate under international law for the United States to be doing what it is doing. In fact, most people would say that the United States is an interested party, and as such, taints automatically any material which it receives that are related to weapons of mass destruction. It's in the inherent interest of the United States of America to get impartial, objective, properly mandated international inspectors into Iraq to take over this investigation, because if Iraq does have weapons of mass destruction programs, these need to be properly identified and properly accounted for. The international community simply is not going to believe any findings put out by an American-only investigation team.
Former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter. Two American soldiers were killed today in separate attacks, at least one of them a bold daylight shooting in Baghdad, military officials said. At least one other soldier was injured when a U.S. vehicle hit an explosive in part of the city believed to have been cleared of landmines. That's according to the Associated Press. In the most brazen attack, an unidentified Iraqi walked up to a soldier on a bridge and opened fire with a pistol, apparently at close range, according to senior U.S. Army officers in Baghdad who had heard reports of the shootings. U.S. Central Command in Qatar said it was unaware of the incident. U.S. forces say they trade fire with armed Iraqis almost daily across the country. It and other incidents demonstrate that the country is still fraught with danger for U.S. forces a month after Saddam Hussein's government fell. Peace Watch correspondent Aaron Glantz is on assignment in Baghdad. During a conversation with Glantz this morning, he spoke of a general state of lawlessness prevailing in the city.
There is a real breakdown, Verna, in the entire civil infrastructure here in Iraq. It has been almost a month since the Americans took this city, and while many people are extremely happy that Saddam Hussein is gone, they are extremely unhappy that a total situation of anarchy is now the norm in Baghdad, that gunmen roam the streets at night, that the looting still has not ended, that people are carjacked on main streets even during the daytime. Nobody wants to travel alone during the day, and it's very scary to travel anywhere at all once the sun goes down. From our apartment, starting at about 8 o'clock at night, about now, there is a steady stream of machine gun fire outside, mostly Iraqis firing at other Iraqis in a simple crime spree, not political, just that the whole infrastructure here has completely collapsed. And the Americans, even though there are over 100,000 troops in Iraq, and you can see them on patrol all the time, don't seem to have any impulse to do anything about this. During the war, the Americans bombed all the key points of the infrastructure. There has been no movement at all on reconstructing any of these, or even cleaning up, I should say, these sites that have been destroyed. The rubble is still there, untouched. Children have begun to play on it, which is very unsafe because who knows what kind of unexploded bombs still lie there that could easily be stepped on. I've been taken into one house already here where an unexploded cluster bomb was sitting in the living room.
Sitting in the living room? For what purpose?
It landed there, and nobody wants to touch it, because if they touch it, it may explode. They've informed the Americans that they would like it taken away, but nobody has come to take it away, so everyone in the house takes great care to avoid this bomb, which could explode at any time. This is especially the case in the outskirts of Baghdad, where many of the military installations are located, which were targeted by the Americans. So in the residential neighborhoods around these military installations, you find many of these unexploded bombs.
Aaron, you say there are 100,000 U.S. troops still there. They're not inclined to do any kind of policing to try and stop the crime spree that you say you're witnessing. What exactly are the troops doing, and how are the people reacting to them?
Well, I mean, the troops don't speak Arabic, which is a big problem. And I was speaking with one sergeant about this, and I asked him why didn't you learn at least rudimentary Arabic, occupation Arabic, if you will, how to say stand back, move away, this is a restricted area, maybe 15 phrases in Arabic. Why didn't they teach you at least these? And they said, because we don't have a mandate from the United Nations to do peacekeeping, so it's against international law for us to do peacekeeping. But in fact, that's exactly what they are doing. So what the American troops do is they go on patrol, they drive their tanks through town, they drive their jeeps through town with their guns poised. They do guard key installations. They guard some hospitals. They guard some universities. They guard the petrol stations so people don't kill each other trying to get gasoline for their cars because there are long lines. Well, but even in these cases, they still don't seem to do that much. I visited a hospital which is guarded by two American tanks and two dozen soldiers where there was a stabbing the night before. So they're very ineffectual at this. I'm still trying to figure out when the American troops find someone who's doing a crime, what exactly they do with them. I found out today that they take them to the National Police Academy Detention Center, but I cannot get an estimate on how many people are being held there, who's being released, who's not, and what's next for them.
And what about the Iraqi police officers that we understood? We heard reports last week that they were putting on their old uniforms and starting to police.
You know, there's a radio here, Verna, called Radio Sawa, which in Arabic means radio together, and it's the new name for the Voice of America radio, and it's very popular here because on the music side of things, they mix up the very popular English music with the very popular Arabic music, and they do have newscasts, and every day on the news on Radio Sawa, the Voice of America radio, you hear about the Iraqi police. In an American press conference this morning that I went to, they were mentioning that the Iraqi police were on the streets, but I have to say that I have seen a grand total of one Iraqi police officer in my entire stay in Iraq, in 1 week in Iraq, and when I told people that I saw a police car with an Iraqi in it, everyone was very impressed because they had not yet seen such a thing. So it's a very difficult situation. I understand that Interpol is involved. I do understand why the Iraqi police are not yet on the streets, because it would be improper to put Saddam's people, if you will, back on the streets, and it does take time to screen and make sure the human rights abusers are not part of the system. But in the meantime, someone should be out on the streets keeping some kind of peace, and that's just not the case.
Well, we understand the vacuum that has been formed as a result of the U.S. and British invasion. And earlier this week in Baghdad, Shia clerics held protests against the U.S. Can you describe what happened there?
I was not there at the time, but let me give you an idea of what you can see if you go to Sadr City, which used to be called Saddam City, and it's the main Shia neighborhood of Baghdad. And the first thing to think about when you think about this city is that It looks really different than the rest of Baghdad. The rest of Baghdad looks very much, as I say, like Los Angeles. It has wide boulevards and tall stucco buildings and a mixture of residential neighborhoods and apartment blocks, streets for cars and not for people. You go to the Shiite neighborhoods and suddenly it doesn't feel like a first world country anymore. Suddenly it feels very much like India. You have garbage everywhere and farm animals in the middle of the biggest city in Iraq, sheep and goats eating the garbage. And in this atmosphere, you have no American troops. The American troops are not in this neighborhood. Instead, what you have is the clerics themselves are keeping control of the streets with their own followers who are armed, as most people are now in Iraq, with automatic weapons. They have their own justice system. They have their own traffic policemen. In fact, it's the only part of Baghdad with any kind of traffic policemen. They have their own systems that they are developing independently in this power vacuum, and they are trying, these clerics, to position themselves so they will be very difficult to deal with in the future if America tries to impose a government.
Well, what does that mean?
Well, you know, it's difficult to say, Verna, exactly what the future holds. But I will tell you that we were interviewing one of the leading sheikhs yesterday, and we asked him, what will you do when the new government, whoever that is, sends police into this neighborhood? Because you have built the police of your followers in this neighborhood. And he said, if the people who come to our neighborhood are our friends and they are greeting us with hospitality, we will greet them. But if they come in a hostile way without the hospitality, then there will be blood in the streets. This is very rhetorical, so, and it's designed to not give a specific answer, but it does indicate the power that they're building, that they could wield if they wanted to.
The White House, on the other hand, has said it will not allow an Iranian-style theocratic government to emerge in Iraq, which it fears will arise out of a Shia-elected government. What kind of hopes have the Iraqis that you've spoken with expressed about the political future of their country?
Well, in terms of this idea of a theocratic government here, I have not been to the south of Iraq, to Basra, to Najaf, where the Shias are the vast majority of the population. Here in Baghdad, the Sunni are the majority of the population, and the idea of the Shia theocracy here is extremely unpopular. In fact, there's a tremendous amount of racism here by Sunnis and Christians and Kurds against the Shia people, because of their religious practices, which are seen by the other religions as very odd and martyristic, if you will. And so I think that it will be very, very difficult for the Shia to try to turn Iraq into an Islamic state. What some observers say is that they may try to partition off part of Iraq to be this kind of theocratic state. The idea that's being floated by the Bush administration and supported by, for example, the Kurds, is to create a federal system in Iraq, and this would allow the Kurds to have free reign in the north and the Shias in the south and the Sunni here in the center in Baghdad, which I suppose is a possibility.
Peace Watch correspondent Aaron Glantz speaking with us this morning from Baghdad.
Fires are burning in Baghdad tonight. Is this what American freedom looks like? Liberator. Riding machines of war, crossing the desert, what are we really there for? We came to liberate oppression and fear, but I don't see the difference. What we're doing there.
Jane Moore, Fires Burning in Baghdad Tonight. Now that the military phase of the invasion in Iraq is winding down, Pentagon and White House officials are focused on restructuring the political system. The U.S. has chosen five Iraqi exiles to form the base of the interim Iraqi government and will now shift efforts towards establishing a more permanent authority. Among the plans is an idea to divide Iraq into three parts, led by American, British, and Polish military forces. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Rahul Mahajan, author of The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He begins by discussing the background of one of the White House's choices to oversee Iraq's transitional government.
Jay Garner, the military proconsul, essentially is on record as praising the Israeli Defense Forces for their remarkable restraint, a very funny claim to anyone who has ever been on the ground in the occupied territories. It is very interesting that such extreme ideologues are being put into positions of power in Iraq, even though it should be clear to the Bush administration that this is simply going to dramatically increase any kind of international opposition. But I don't think it's the most important issue. The question is not so much who should the proconsul, the imperial proconsul, be in Iraq, but why is it that the United States, when it claims to bring democracy, is instead imposing a proconsul at all?
And what about the actual plan that this proconsul is intending to implement? We hear that the Bush administration is planning to divide Iraq into three military sectors controlled by the U.S., British, and Polish forces. What effects do you think this will have on the stability in the region? And do you see this as perhaps creating political tensions in the Middle East in the future?
Well, I think the main thing that's going to create political tensions is the existence of a U.S. occupying force. And in fact, part of the reason that they are now bringing in others, although both Poland and the U.K. were involved in the war, is to dilute the effects of that U.S. force. The main goals they have are not dividing up the country, although they are doing this administrative division. The main goals they have, which they've already expressed clearly, are two: military occupation, which is to say the creation of permanent military bases in Iraq, and the express intent to use that military leverage for greater regional domination. And it's already been used quite effectively against Syria with almost no effort by the United States. They simply had to cut off the flow of oil from the Iraqi pipeline to Syria to get Syria to acquiesce to U.S. demands. And the other is the oil, to privatize the oil industry. They're talking openly about that right now.
Also, we're seeing reports today from The Guardian that Washington is pressing the U.N. to take action against Iran over its alleged nuclear weapons development program. The U.S. has accused Iran of secretly embarking on a program to enrich uranium at Natanz in southern Iran, which it fears could be used to make nuclear weapons in contravention of an international treaty. Your response to that?
Well, first of all, I think everyone has to understand that the U.S. war on Iraq made proliferation impossible to prevent. Every country has learned the same lesson, that cooperation with disarmament does not, that means that you're more likely to be attacked by the United States. John Bolton, speaking about a month ago, said that Iran, Syria, and North Korea should learn a lesson from the war in Iraq, that they should not have weapons of mass destruction. But very obviously, the lesson they learned is that Iraq was disarming and it was attacked anyway. And North Korea has articulated the real lesson to be learned, which is if you don't get your own nuclear deterrent, then you are constantly in danger. And so we're going to expect some countries will do it openly, other countries will do it behind closed doors, but disarmament has been made almost a dead letter by this latest war of the United States and by its open contempt for any semblance of international cooperation or international treaties. So Iran may well be looking to develop a nuclear capacity, and at this point it's hard to blame them because they figure that's probably the only way to keep from being attacked by the United States.
So if we could look again at this whole idea of carving Iraq into three parts, into three military sectors, and the effect that that might have on the entire Middle Eastern region.
At this point, you have basically a population in Iraq that the majority of which feels that it has been oppressively ruled by a minority, the Sunni Arabs. mostly centered around living in central Iraq, and of course epitomized by every regime since the colonial one put in by the British after World War One, has been dominated by Sunni Arabs. And so both the Kurds and perhaps in some ways even more the Shia Arabs in the south resent that greatly. The Kurds, as in the rest of the region, have been systematically deprived of basic rights and any kind of regional autonomy, even though Iraq was actually at one time gave them, legally speaking, gave them regional autonomy, but in fact did not. So there are real serious questions here. The Kurds have some rights which have not been recognized. The Shia are the majority, the Shia Arabs are the majority in the country, and in any kind of elections would have a dominant role, but then there are legitimate concerns minorities have. The only problem is that the United States is simply using those legitimate concerns to further its own kind of domination of the region in a pretty typical colonial pattern. First you define more sharply the differences, you do a little bit to exacerbate them, and then you say that in fact your presence is needed in order to protect the interests of everyone. In fact, what we're seeing now, I think, is the real possibility of these different factions within Iraq working out their own differences. And I think there's a broad understanding among all of the whole Iraqi political spectrum that there do need to be guarantees. And there's also a broad understanding that they don't need the United States to enforce those guarantees.
And what about having the U.S., Britain, and Poland actually oversee these various sectors? Poland has said that it wants a UN mandate before launching any kind of peacekeeping force, and other nations have also expressed anger over U.S. plans to restructure Iraq without the authority of the United Nations. If the U.S. goes ahead with its plan, would that set a new precedent?
Well, the United States has been very consistently doing its best to set new precedents. The end goal has already become very clear. It is to say more and more explicitly and overtly that the United Nations, far from being the overarching authority that all countries have agreed, essentially, they've ratified the UN Charter and have agreed that the United Nations is the ultimate arbiter of international disputes, not of purely national questions, but of international disputes of any kind. And so the United States is signed into this system in a formal sense, but has more and more openly tried to dominate the UN to the point now where it's almost that it wants to an explicit restatement that, in fact, the UN is simply a subordinate organ of U.S. policy.
Mm.
Britain and Poland are there simply as loyal spear carriers for the United States and will not be expected to deviate from any U.S. line to any degree.
Any final thoughts on your part, Rahul?
Well, I guess the most important thing is there was a worldwide anti-war movement which came together because I think people around the world understood that the war on Iraq didn't just affect the United States and Iraqis, or didn't just affect the Middle East. It affects everyone because it represents a tremendous increase in U.S. political domination of the world, and the results of that have become, over the past decade especially, very clear to everyone. This new world order ushered in by George Bush and then Bill Clinton and now brought to such an extreme and cancerous state by George W. Bush is one that's very bad for the people of the world, and they resisted it, and there was this global movement which unfortunately couldn't stop the war. Right now, it's just almost as important an issue as it was then. The question of democracy in Iraq, whether the Iraqi people will actually be able to get a government that is independent, that obeys their wishes, that has the potential to say no when the United States wants military bases, to say no to the privatization of its own oil, the denationalization, and to say no to U.S. goals of regional hegemony as part of its plans of global hegemony, that question of democracy in Iraq is almost as important to the people of the world as the question of war was. And it would be nice to see, I think, a regeneration of that global opposition. And there's no time like the present. It's the next year in which the question of Iraq's independence will be decided. In general, in popular resistance, there's a good understanding of the kinds of actions, popular education, mobilization, demonstrations, and so on. And I think the message is fairly clear as well. There can be no democracy, no meaningful democracy in Iraq with a government and a system set up under a U.S. military occupation, especially when the United States has made so clear what its real goals in the region are. The only way to have a democratic process is to get the U.S. troops out, to figure out some way to stabilize the country, which may involve a genuine multinational U.N. peacekeeping force and not a U.S.-dominated one. In fact, there should be no Americans in the peacekeeping force, or British, or Poles, or Australians, because they were involved in an aggressive war against Iraq. And once there is some stabilization, there should be a real political dialogue leading to something meaningful like a constitutional convention, not this kind of scripted puppet show where the U.S. military convenes the politicians it wants and gets them to agree essentially on plans that it likes.
Rahul Mahajan, author of The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.